from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at why the risk of flooding has increased due to climate change.
As of now, I think there's just a large amount of unawareness about flood risk, about flood policy options, and about the financial devastation that can occur if a flood event happens at your house.
Then we'll visit the Crave Brothers Farm and learn how they repurpose manure produced by their cows.
Farming can go through its really tough periods, right? So we tried to create something that had more momentum, so when you do hit a tough spell, down markets, weather challenges, that you can come out the other side.
Plus, we'll learn about the food and beauty that's created by Milwaukee's Cherry Street Garden. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. What does the future of climate disasters and mitigation look like in Wisconsin? Earlier this year, a group of UW-Milwaukee graduate students partnered with Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources to find out. Their report, called Rising Waters, Rising Costs, looked at how flooding has already impacted Wisconsin residents and what can be done. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez is joined by the graduate students to talk about the report. But first, we'll hear from Milwaukee resident Tom Maddox about how he's been impacted by flooding.
How has this neighborhood changed as far as this bioswale? Like, what do you remember being here when you were in business all that time ago?
Here was just open field, flat ground. They had said one time that this was going to be apartments put here, but end up not apartments. And this used to be a park right here, and they taking the park away and put this back right here because they said that it would be people in the community would be employed at the factory, but I don't know how many people from the community works over there, but they took that park out of the community.
You know, one of the things we're looking at and talking to people about is flooding. Have you had flooding in your businesses or your house over the years?
I had flooding in my home 10, 11 years or so, somewhere around in that ballpark area. But yeah, my basement flooded real bad. Couldn't go down there no more before I made it to the bottom of the step because water was just everywhere over there. And I called FEMA, whoever that was, came and they came and, you know, estimated did. And after, I think, a couple of days or so, the water did go down.
Did you have flood insurance at the time?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I got paid, you know, for it. They paid me for my stuff, damage and stuff. But, you know, I'd rather not for it to be damaged because, you know, you get old stuff that you have that some of my grandparents' stuff that I had that, you know, you lose the water, get to it. So you can't recover that type of stuff, you know, sentimental values, you can't recover.
Are you all ready for your moment?
I think so.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll try my best. So my name is Evelyn. I was a second year student at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And on the report, I worked on the green infrastructure solutions in Milwaukee.
Hi, I'm Cami Armendariz. I am going to be in my second year at UW-Milwaukee as a water policy master's student. And within the report, I was doing flood risk and socioeconomic data mapping.
How's it going? My name is Joe McCormick. I'm also a freshwater policy student at UWM, and in this report I focused on the overlay of flood insurance with those socioeconomic indicators.
Can you tell me about the impact that flooding has in Wisconsin? What did you all learn about that?
Sure. I mean, flooding is the most common and most costly natural disaster in the state of Wisconsin. And with the effects of climate change, it's expected that more frequent and severe storms are going to increase the amount of flood damage that takes place. So municipalities around Wisconsin are working really hard to shore up their own mitigation techniques. But even if you have the best mitigation techniques, you know, there's still always going to be flood risk, which is why we try to emphasize the adoption of personal flood insurance policies.
What makes an area susceptible to like flood risk or flood damage?
In the city of Milwaukee, it's susceptible to flood damage because there's a lot of impervious surfaces here. And
so like looking around a neighborhood like this where you can see large buildings, abandoned manufacturing, a lot of hard surfaces, very little trees. This would be like a pretty prime example of like impervious surfaces and like susceptible to flooding.
Yep, exactly. And within this area, in our report, we looked at the socioeconomic indicators, but a lot of that is areas where it was all hardscape now because of the community and the history of the urbanization of people, I guess.
Socioeconomic mapping.
Yes.
What is it? Why does it matter? And what does it tell us about flooding and how to keep people not wet?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so FEMA has normally like been the historic kind of like landmark figure that delineates 100-year floodplains, which is kind of what Evelyn was just talking about. And these floodplains tend to have a lot of prior data mapped on them. It's what like local municipalities, other things are kind of relying on when they're trying to prepare for any flooding disasters that are going to happen. But then again, there's a lot of floodplains that aren't actually mapped by FEMA, or the ones that are mapped, just it's old data. It's not really focused on socioeconomic indicators. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong there where municipalities aren't really prepared. So a really important thing is not only to apply like ecological things to when you're mapping for FEMA, but also applying in socioeconomic indicators. And that can range from like, okay, how many people have like diabetes in this area, to a large thing we focused on was like renters and things like that. Cause there's the ability to kind of recover from a big natural disaster changes like drastically, whether you own your house or whether you're a renter, in terms of the, if you got that insurance or anything. Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Harvey were excellent examples that we utilized in our report that really showed how much more renters suffered, and then especially Black and Hispanic populations in the area. So there was one really great project by Groundwork Milwaukee, and I'm forgetting their other partners they were working with, but they specifically focused on Milwaukee as their case study and outlined a ton of socioeconomic indicators, again, ranging from diabetes to how many people are in the household, income, and countless others. I highly recommend reading through their report.
If we're talking about renters, which the majority of Metcalf Park residents are renters, what are some of the insufficiencies when it comes to like flooding insurance, and then specifically dealing with renters?
Sure. So we talked earlier about flood zones. Flood zones delineate risk, and they're categorized from X to V, and each different region has a different level of risk. Things that are called SFHAs, or Special Flood Hazard Areas, SFHAs. Those are areas where you've got mortgage requirements to have flood insurance. So if you want to get a mortgage and you want it backed by the federal government, you need to have a flood insurance policy. And as a result, that's kind of the only regions where you see widespread adoption of flood insurance policies. There's currently no mandates for standard renters insurance to include flood insurance.
So why would they?
Exactly. And I think a lot of people don't understand their risks. There's been a lot of academic evidence to support the fact that people generally have really poor risk perception. They don't think it'll happen to them. And, you know, traditionally it's been expensive. So flood insurance historically has always been operated by these two levels. It's private, which is relatively new, and the FEMA National Flood Insurance Program, the NFIP. And the NFIP covers the entire nation, right? It's been around since 1968. It's extremely debt saddled due to these high extreme payout events like Katrina and Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Ida. It's paying hundreds of millions of dollars every year just to pay off its own debt. And, you know, future federal funding looks a little grim. So that's where private insurance needs to step up and offer more customizable options with different price points based on risk. There's a lot more advanced modeling that allows for them to create these more nuanced policies. But as of now, I think there's just a large amount of unawareness about flood risk, about flood policy options, and about the financial devastation that can occur if a flood event happens at your house.
All right, Evelyn, I've got a question, because if we're talking about how do you serve like underserved, underinvested communities, I feel like 30th Street Corridor, this right here in front of us, is an example of that. So can you tell me a little bit about what you learned with the work with MMSD in the 30th Street Corridor?
Yeah, so MMSD is kind of targeting those underserved communities, and infrastructure is really costly to fix over time. So to kind of combat that and take like a better approach, they're also implementing green infrastructure such as bioswales. And those are large stormwater basins that help capture water where it falls and prevent water from going into those pipes and over flooding that system, because then that's going to lead to a sewer overflow, which then dumps a mixture of raw sewage and stormwater into Lake Michigan, which we don't want. So this is kind of preventing that from happening. So they kind of just reach out to underserved communities and tell them about the projects that are happening and make them familiar with what's being done in their community, and then also kind of give them strategies that they can help implement, such as small-scale green infrastructure, like rain barrels and rain gardens in their own homes, which they help provide and educate the community on as well.
What surprised you about your study and just going through the data and learning what you did?
For me, at least, when looking at the data, just like the extreme number of like flooding blind spots that are missed in mapping. There's like a lot of flood risk hotspots where like there's significant pluvial flooding, which just means that the drainage systems, again, like Evelyn mentioned earlier, are going to be overwhelmed and these areas are going to be heavily flooded and damaged. So looking at maps where you look at traditional FEMA mapping tools versus when you combine social vulnerability data, you'll see so many more communities that are going to be affected.
Yeah, and I guess I would just add to that, when you look at the insurance adoption, it similarly points to a lot of coverage gaps. FEMA data suggests the fact that over 80% of all residential NFIP policies are held by individual homeowners and not 2 to 4 family residences, which suggests a real lack of coverage for renters and people living in multiple unit buildings.
I'd say just learning about the 30th Street Corridor projects and the basins themselves was super interesting as I kind of focus on the green infrastructure. I believe the West Basin, which is the larger of the three, can capture up to 31 million gallons of water, which is just really hard to even picture in your mind, like how much water that is. So I think that's really neat and cool.
What I'm hoping this story gets to is like the solutions part of everything. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious if there are other parts of the solutions and the takeaways that you all highlighted or featured in the report.
For mine, for people themselves, would be just to look into, like, MMSC offers programs for rain barrels and rain gardens. Just finding out what resources there are for you as a person to try to capture water where it falls and install your own small-scale green infrastructure, because that will help capture water where it falls and prevent flooding and overwhelming of the sewer system.
You should get flood insurance. It's estimated that 1 inch of flood damage can cost $25,000 worth of damage. I don't think people quite understand their risk. I don't think people are fully aware of the financial devastation that can occur with an uninsured flood event. There's a lot of flexible flood insurance packages, and there's a lot of government relief programs that are worth looking into if you're currently uninsured. It's definitely worth exploring. Get flood insurance.
I would say for just organizations, government employees, other officials who are dealing with this and trying to find solutions, make sure you're communicating to the public in a very engaging way, creating visuals that are understandable to the public. Again, Groundwork Milwaukee made like an Esri story map. And if you look at it, the colors are beautiful. Just making something that the general public, someone who knows nothing about flood insurance, who doesn't know what any of these acronyms mean, they can get it and they'll want to keep reading it. So just make it science communication and make it good.
That was UWM School of Freshwater Science graduate students Cami Armendariz, Joe McCormick, and Evelyn Grimm, authors of Rising Waters, Rising Costs. They spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez last month. Over 1 billion pounds of food waste is discarded annually, making it the largest contributor to our landfills. That's according to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Despite this alarming amount of food waste, 1 in 7 households face food insecurity. Alina Joling wants to decrease food waste and help support farmers in the off-season with her store, Farmers Market To Go. The store offers local growers a place to sell their food outside of farmers markets and gives consumers a place to get fresh, local food year-round. Joling joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and starts with Farmers Market To Go's unique business model.
Technically, I'm the owner, but all the vendors own their own shelves. They keep 100% of their profits. So it is organized more like a cooperative without some of the legal challenges that cooperatives face. Essentially, we wanted to give space year-round to growers, farmers, and producers that are local. They have a tough time getting into bigger grocery stores, and so farmers market season is really where they make a majority of their income. And that can mean very hard winter months, of course. So a lot of farmers even have greenhouses that they don't use. And we would like to see more of those used during those winter months if they had just a place to sell it. So the way it's organized is that vendors can buy their own shelf. They share the monthly expenses. They keep all their profits. We don't add anything to the price. We don't take anything from, you know, their ultimate outcome because their profit margins are pretty small, especially when you're working on a smaller scale. And then for us on the consumer side, which I am, it's so that we can eat this really good food all year round instead of just during the farmer's market season.
Yeah. And you are also a business owner outside of establishing Farmers Market to Go. So what kind of lessons did you learn from your other entrepreneurship journeys that influenced a different model that you'd like to employ to allow your farmers to keep, you know, their profits?
Sure. So Melita was my first business, and it was a knife sharpening business that I started because I wanted to see a higher quality sharpening out there. And we really focus a lot on education so that customers know, you know, no matter where they're going to get their stuff sharpened, what to look for, what to look out for. But we really made a majority of our income at farmers markets. And just like all other vendors, you know, we had that plummet in the winter. So we started a kitchen store that's Better Knife and Kitchen Store. And that's now, you know, sort of an extension. It gives people more of a reason to come out during those winter months rather than making a special trip just for sharpening. And, you know, I think a lot of times when we're facing a problem, we can think it's just our own problem, when really it's probably something everybody struggles with. And the more that I talk to these folks that I've been doing markets with for, this is going to be my 15th season. So we've been working together for a long time. I'd find out that they had that same exact issue where it was really tough to maintain the staff that you need during the summer season, during those winter months. Also, kind of like, I didn't realize how much local food was being wasted until my farmers market friends, they would find out that I was a farm kid, and suddenly I'd be getting gifted these obscene amounts of produce. Yeah. And, you know, I would say, you know, Tom, I really don't need a lot of carrots, just a few. And I'd turn around and he's running away from my table, leaving a gigantic box. And I kind of started to question them about, you know, like, why are you doing this to me? Because they knew they are giving me work, you know, they're not just giving me, it seems like it is a beautiful gift, don't get me wrong, local stuff, local produce is some of the best we got. But they knew I would be up until 3 a.m. canning or, you know, preserving it in some sort of way. And they really told me, like, well, we're giving it to you because we know you're a farm kid, we know you won't waste it. Mm. And I was just kind of shocked. I was like, this would just go to waste otherwise. Here I thought, like, you know, they'd have many places that they could sell or bring it to after the markets, but turns out a lot of the times it's compost. So that really, and that was probably a decade ago, that I really started going, man, we really need a place to sell this stuff all year round. And even after the markets during the week in the summer, that they can drop stuff off and have a further chance. And then all the people too, who don't necessarily have time, or maybe they're working during the 4 hours that the market is once a week, that they can't make it to those markets. And I think a lot of people, even in the restaurant industry in particular, I think of, they love to cook. They want to eat, you know, the higher quality food too, but not being able to make it to those markets because of those later hours.
Right. Now, with the relationships you've established being at farmers markets for the past 15 years, you have used that pool of people to also help support your business. So tell me about your team and, you know, what roles Jenny Lee and Angela Mo play.
Yeah. So I've known both of them for quite some time. Angela is been one of my biggest like supporters and fans, actually, since I started my sharpening business. We did the Shorewood Farmers Market together since its inception, really. And she had this same sort of concept. She had tried, you know, several times to help other people get it going, but they always saw it fail. When she told me that, I was like, give me all the advice. Give me everything you learned from those experiences, because we're certainly not immune to that. So my, you know, sort of the different thing that we're doing is that you know, we're not adding anything to the price. We're not taking anything. And I think that's important to run a space like this and not do it to make a profit, because it makes it unaffordable for the customers who want to shop there. It makes it really, I guess, just too expensive for anybody, you know, because the farmers and producers, if they're not selling as much, they're really not going to be able to sustain keeping their products there either. So she was a great help in just like giving ideas and being a good sounding board when we wanted to try this or that when we were first starting. And Jenny Lee has this huge presence in the Milwaukee food scene. And there is actually a space. And so this is really exciting, too, that we have this like additional new thing coming, is that in this space, it used to be a bar and a restaurant. We split it up into threes, so now it's like a salt and sauna place, get your wellness on. You know, we have the kitchen store with Molita sharpening, and then farmer's market to go, of course. There's actually still, and we're developing it in the next couple of months, is a commercial kitchen, to have a new rentable commercial kitchen, because these are really, really needed. And that's been a huge thing I've learned in talking to all the vendors, too. I really went into this not knowing anything about the food industry, about licensing. You know, a huge thank you to the county health department for really, I talked to them early, as well as the Department of Agriculture. They were fantastic at like meeting with me, talking me through, answering really any little question that I had. But one of the things and the biggest obstacles, and I've seen it over and over and over again now, is not having access to a commercial kitchen. Because in order to sell anything retail, you can't do the home baker license or the pickle bill. You have to have that commercial kitchen to work out of. And a lot of them are, they're huge, they're beautiful, but they're not really set up for very small makers or people who only need necessarily a portion of a kitchen. So I think we have an opportunity to do something different there as well, where it's broken up into sections that people can rent. And I think it's going to enable a lot of people who started their small business, you know, they're entrepreneurs, but they're having a hard time making it out of that farmer's market, like just doing anything beyond that. I think it's really going to help. That's where Jenny Lee comes in. She's got all the commercial kitchen experience. I've got all the build-out experience. We're sort of joining forces to make this happen. And I think that's when we're going to see Farmers Market to go really take off, too, with a lot more. Because we do have convenience food. You know, we have food for the busy folks, too. It's just endless, the combinations and meals. I think it's a lot bigger than most people expect when they hear about it. And then they come in and they go, whoa. And we're like, yeah, we've got like 50 vendors at this point. We've got 100 shelves that are full of delicious local food.
You mentioned you're a farm girl and grew up here in Wisconsin on a farm. Do you credit that for your community mindset to have a model where you're consciously saying like, no, it's about staying operational and supporting other people?
I do think that is some to credit, because when you grow up with that close of a relationship to your food, you really see all the work that goes into it. I think there's a lot of people who fantasize about that lifestyle that don't know what it really takes. I mean, just to say like, yeah, I could go without vacations because, you know, animals can't not be fed. So unless you're like a wealthy farmer who can afford farmhands or that type of thing, it is a pretty sustenance lifestyle. And I think what really motivated a lot of it, too, was going from the country, growing up on a farm, and then moving to the city and noticing the biggest difference between country poor and city poor was the food, period. Like, I might have had, you know, a similar, like, we weren't one of those wealthy farmers, we'll say that. But I got to eat like a queen. I realized I was probably eating better than a lot of wealthy people in bigger cities, even, because I was eating it fresh out of the garden. I was eating it, you know, like pretty freshly butchered meat, all of that. And even the way that we treated the animals, everything about it was just on a higher level. So I was like, wow, those are the really two biggest differences. And then I've been really inspired, too, by like, you know, the work of Miss Venus Williams. I've done markets with her for a very long time, too. And I'm going, yes, because that is the biggest difference between, you know, poverty in these two places, is a closer connection with the food and having access to more fresh, locally grown and produced food.
Well, Alina, I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing to try and make this gap a little smaller and to share where food comes from with the greater public.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time today, Audrey.
Alina Joling is the owner of Farmers Market To Go in Brookfield. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski this spring. Neighborhood beauty is something that is often overlooked as an aspect of health. In about 15 minutes, we'll visit a community garden that takes beauty seriously by inviting students to create art and infrastructure to supplement the fresh produce and flowers already growing there. But first, we'll explore Crave Brothers Farmstead in Waterloo, Wisconsin, and how they're making the most of their manure. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Modern agriculture can create a lot of waste, but that doesn't mean it needs to go to waste. At Crave Brothers Farmstead in Waterloo, Wisconsin, they're turning that waste into profit by reusing the manure made by their cows. Liquids, solids, and even gas created by manure are repurposed around the farm in the form of fertilizer, bedding, and methane that's used to create electricity that powers their farm, cheese factory, and homes in their community. It's all made possible with the anaerobic methane digester, a device that separates the different parts of the manure. In 2023, I ventured out to the farmstead and met up with Mark Crave, one of the brothers and the general manager of Crave Brothers. As we walked around the farm, there were large metal tankers with big pipes venting out gas. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. They had a distinct smell.
What is on these trucks? I keep seeing
them. These trucks right here are hauling manure.
Okay.
And so we are required. We're a CAFO. We're an evil CAFO, right, that we hear about. We cannot apply manure from the time the ground freezes up in the fall until 1st of April, meaning we can't haul on frozen ground. Of course, the cows are living every day. They're producing milk every day, and they're also generating manure every day. We store it. And then when spring comes, we apply it to the fields, as I described earlier, as fertilizer for the crops we're going to grow. So all of those fields, we take soil samples and determine what nutrients are in the soil. Then we also know through research, through science, how much of the subsequent crop is going to utilize, whether it be corn, wheat, soybeans, alfalfa is what we grow. And we know that a corn crop will use X amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, etc. throughout the growing season. So we match what the soil already has in it, what the plant's going to need, and we make up the difference with our manure and other fertilizer. And so today we're just, it's our first day of hauling this spring. The last time we hauled was around Thanksgiving time.
Oh, yep. All right.
So it's a lot of activity, but we have to have a lot of storage so that we can apply it at the time of the years when we're permitted to. And also we get, by applying it now, we get more effective value out of it versus the manure sitting there all winter and volatilizing, especially nitrogen. Nitrogen will volatilize, go up in the air.
What do you have excess manure? Is that something that comes up?
No, we don't have excess. We because we have a closed loop, we can match how much we apply with the crops that we're taking off. So no, we don't have excess manure. We apply it. You know, the times we have excess really are around, but depending on our crop rotation. So for example, corn will use a lot more nutrients than soybeans will. Soybeans, being a legume, will generate their own nitrogen. So we match the manure to the crop that we're growing, the amount of manure.
All right.
And so by doing that, we bring in very little outside fertilizer, right?
So these animals eat the alfalfa. Do they eat corn? Do they eat soybeans?
Yes.
Are these all crops that they're eating?
Yes. So we'll go look at that next. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
This is just a big shed where we store feed. So on a livestock operation, including dairy, feed is our number one expense. In our case, it's probably about 45% of our production cost. So it's a huge part of what we do. And we match feed and nutrition are one and the same, right? And we're matching the nutritional needs of the livestock with what crops we can grow in the glacial drumlin terrain of southern Wisconsin. For us here, our number one crop is corn, and corn for silage. And what that means is instead of harvesting the grain, you harvest the entire plant and chop it up. Of course, cows are ruminants. They need a lot of fiber, and they can digest fiber that you and I can't. And so they do a great job of taking materials that would otherwise go to waste. If we just harvested the corn, shipped the corn down the Mississippi River, all those corn stalks would stay in the field. But in our case, we harvest all the corn stalks and the grain, goes through the cows, and then what the cow doesn't digest ends up back on the field in the form of manure.
One of the questions I have, especially looking at where all the cows are, how do you collect their manure? To me, there doesn't seem an obvious collection site.
Well, we'll go see that. Yeah, manure management is a big part of what we do in designing our farms and our livestock facilities, certainly. So every year, these silos are filled and emptied. It's a constant cycle, filling and emptying. There's no start or stop to an agricultural or a livestock system. You know, it's kind of the whole chicken and egg thing, if you pardon the pun. But, you know, it starts with the crop, but of course, in the end, we have the cow manure that we put it back on the fields for fertilizing the next crop. So there's no point in time that you say, here's where our season stops and starts. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun that way. You're always part of the loop. Not every farm does this. So now we're kind of getting into a specialized area where there's maybe 20 or 25 farms in the state. But this is a manure digester system. So there's another tank like this over here. We have two tanks. And you know what? I'm going to pull up here and we can get out. We collect the cow's manure. So you say, how do you collect it? Well, it's built in the system where we collect the cow's manure. We pump it in these tanks. And in there, again, it ferments. And it's about 100 degrees. We add heat to it to where it ferments at that heat and it generates methane. We pipe off the methane. And in our case, we run it through an engine that turns a generator. And so we're actually producing electricity. We also run whey from our cheese factory through here. And whey has a lot of lactose in it, which is highly fermentable. Right? It's sugar.
Was the vision always to be like this? Like how you say, integrated, localized?
A little bit. We'd always liked farming. We always liked the work associated with it, like caring for cattle. But especially my older brothers always had a little bit more of a vision beyond just having a farm and creating something that had a little more momentum to it. And farming can go through its really tough periods, right? So we tried to create something that had more momentum so when you do hit a tough spell, down markets, weather challenges, that you can come out the other side. Certainly didn't envision having our own cheese plant at that time, but that fell into that mindset. We were already dairy farming 20 years when we decided to get in the cheese business. And so, but that fit in the whole thing of creating our own markets. Again, as I said, creating a little more momentum, capturing a little more of the consumer dollar than we were able to just by selling commodity milk. And now with that, we have the digester in place. We've grown staff. So when I first moved here in '88 with my brothers, the four of us provided 95% of the labor on the farm. We had a couple neighbor kids that come over, high school kids, and help us out. And it was a fun. We were young and full of energy, but it got to be drudgery. And over time, we knew that we needed to scale the place up so we could specialize a little bit, so we could have more of a modern lifestyle than what dairy farmers had typically experienced. And so with that, we grew staff. We developed our cheese business. Now we have 11 family members and 80 full-time non-family staff. Everything from people that feed calves, milk cows, feed the cows, run the digester. Across the road, we have lab personnel. We have several cheesemakers. My brother and my nephew are cheesemakers also. Shipping, receiving, the whole thing. So it's kind of fun because we have mechanics. So of those 80 people, we have the full gamut of skill sets. And so it's really fun to see that and develop that and just try to make it all work.
This is a really big operation, as you say. You even actually described yourself as a CAFO.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that as someone who grew up on a farm? Because there's so much controversy around CAFOs.
There's controversy for people that don't understand what they are. There's no controversy for me, right? It's a badge of honor for me because I know, again, the details behind what it is, what the regulations are. So being a CAFO just means you're regulated. So we operate at a set of rules that farms that aren't CAFOs don't even have to deal with. So actually, most CAFOs operate at a higher level of environmental stewardship and sustainability than maybe what some other farms do for one reason is because we're regulated. Another thing is we're able to build that in. As we grow our dairy farms, we're able to incorporate a lot of those things into our facilities, right? So when we build a barn, we incorporate the manure handling and the cow cooling and some of the things that benefit the cow, that benefit the environment. We're able to bring in the digester. A farm with 50 cows can't afford a digester, right? They just can't. It just doesn't scale, right? And so the devil is, again, really in the details. And if you really dive into it and look at it closely, CAFOs are actually on the cutting edge of a lot of stewardship initiatives. You got one thing to remember, a lot of CAFOs got to be that way, got to be large farms because they were very good farmers. They were very good farmers when they had 25 cows or 50 cows or 100 cows, and they kept growing it. They were economically successful, they knew what they were doing, and they kept growing it and growing it and growing it. I don't know of a single CAFO that exists because somebody said, you know what, I don't care about anything else, I just want this big business. No, they all came via evolution of a start with a smaller farm.
It seems like for you, to some extent, sustainability, I don't want to say it was an afterthought, but you've really focused on the cows kind of experience, the dairy part of it. And then it seemed like, oh, well, since we're doing this, since we have so many head of cattle, or since we have so many cows here, we should start to incorporate these aspects of sustainability. Where would you say it lands on your priorities now? Do you think sustainability is a key to your operation?
Yeah, certainly. You know, and that is somewhat an accurate description. When I first started farming, we were all concerned about crops and cows, right? Then it got to be, well, we can't do this ourselves, so we need to hire staff. So now we developed ourselves as teaching, mentoring, training staff, right? So now we're people, right? And I'm going back to like the 1990s, right? Then we got to where we started looking at the technology change, cover crops, low tillage, you know, reduced tillage, no-till systems, things like that came into vogue in the 2000s. And so it just slowly creeps into what you do. First and foremost, you have to remember, as I've shared, a lot of what we do other than the digester, we would do regardless. We've always used manure for fertilizer. We've always harvested our feeds and kept it local. We've just expanded on that whole mindset. People have fed brewer's grain to cows in southern Wisconsin for 100 years. You know, I know a lot of old-timers that said, oh, I used to drive my dad into Milwaukee with a truck and fill it up with brewer's grain and feed it to the cows. So that's always existed. We just don't talk about it a lot. But now, one of the things we've embraced the sustainability mindset on this farm because we're already doing so much of it. A lot of farmers go, oh, what are they talking about? I say, no, think about it. We're already doing a lot of things that people want us to do. We just have to, number one, explain what we're doing, and number two, use the science and the information, use the numbers behind it, so that instead of somebody saying, oh, farmers are just dumping manure on their fields. No, we're not dumping manure on our fields. We're putting manure out at a rate that's a prescription to meet the needs of that growing crop. It's very sustainable, right? CAFOs have no choice. We sign our name on a line that says this is how we're gonna do it. And if I sign my name on it and say that's what I'm gonna do, then I do it. So I don't sign it.
Mark Crave is the general manager of Crave Brothers Farmstead in Waterloo, Wisconsin. He spoke with me and Lena Tran at the farmstead in 2023. When we come back, we'll visit Milwaukee's Cherry Street Garden and learn about the approach to food stability and beauty there. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When you think of the Housing Authority of Milwaukee, you probably think of, well, housing. But one Housing Authority lot is serving a different purpose, neighborhood beautification. Located near 23rd and Cherry Street in the Midtown neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side, Cherry Street Community Garden is a place for residents to connect to their agricultural roots and nurture beauty. Cherry Street Garden is a place for area residents, many living in adjacent Housing Authority property, to gather amongst food and art. Lake Effect Sam Woods visited the garden in 2023 to learn how it was funded and what it has become.
In a city of concrete, nicknamed after cream-colored bricks, keeping a connection to your family's agricultural roots might seem impossible. or at least impractical. But Santana Webb is finding a way. She has been growing food next to her Midtown neighborhood home for over 10 years, together with her grandmother, Linda. Now, I visited her garden plot recently, and let me tell you, she beams with pride when she tells me about everything she's growing, from the tomatoes to the jalapenos, the peppers, the beans, all of it. But she also is reflective about how nurturing these crops helps her connect to her family's southern roots.
My mom and my grandmother was actually raised in the South, so they make fried green tomatoes every now and then, and tomatoes are just great. And then the collards, my mom and my grandmother, when they were in the South, they used to let the frost hit them first, and then they would pick them because they taste better like that, and they're more like tender and stuff. So, and then she stores them in freezer bags so she could use them for like holidays like New Year's Eve, Christmas. Sometimes she cooks them on Easter, so just like special events.
And while Santana is the one connecting to family traditions established in previous generations, she actually played a big role in getting her family gardening again after they moved to Milwaukee. Originally starting in the Cherry Street Garden with her grandmother as a child, she slowly brought more and more of her family across the parking lot from their home to dig into the soil and develop their roots.
Basically, after like the first or second year of gardening, I went back to my mother and I was telling her about it, and like I was so eager. Like my mom, she knew that I really liked it. So I asked her, would she start coming out and get a garden for me, and so we could have our own garden? And she was like, all right. She was like, I'll try it. And so she started coming with me and my grandmother. And basically, once we got her out, we got my other grandmother out. And since then, everyone has been gardening.
Stories like these bring a smile to Lisa Ruskowski's face. In 2012, Lisa and her husband, Rick, founded Cherry Street Garden, built on land owned by the Housing Authority and operated by Bloom MKE, a nonprofit that manages the garden, in addition to providing gardening education programs and even little free library book drives. The garden was named for its proximity to Cherry Street in Milwaukee's Midtown neighborhood. But the cherry trees that line the garden's borders today would coincidentally come later.
Yeah, this garden's really blossomed over the last 10, 12 years. So we started with 19 raised beds. We've now grown to 33, plus a few little spot gardens to kind of highlight some additional growing techniques. And then in 2015, the city put in an orchard space here. So we have cherry trees growing at Cherry Street Garden.
Makes sense.
And then I think we're actually the only orchard that got the cherry trees that year. So we're very happy to have those.
They probably saw your application in the grant. Like, well, we have to give it to them, right?
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular also. The cherry trees are incredibly productive. Anybody and everybody should come by and pick those in July because we have plenty to share.
All right.
And then we have the apple trees, which are just coming into bloom now, or into harvest time now, making some amazing apple cider out here in the garden, a few different events. So we've grown both in the number of beds we have as well as having the orchard. And we've also refurbished a lot of our beds from being the original 8-inch high beds to being more accessible 24-inch beds, because more than half the gardeners here are older or elderly and or physically disabled. So our goal is for people to be able to easily reach into their bed, to be fully participating in the garden experience.
Yeah, and so on that note of the gardeners who are here, the people who are gardening here, I see names on a lot of these beds, right? And from talking to some of the gardeners, my understanding is that a lot of them live in the surrounding area, right?
Correct. So almost everybody who gardens here lives within walking distance. So either they live a block over at the Cherry Court Apartments, which is the Housing Authority building, or there's our surrounding neighborhoods, neighbors, which is great. Keeps a lot of eyes on the garden, keeps people walking over and engaged. This is classified as a food desert, so it's really nice to have a space here where healthy food's getting grown. We have a couple beds that we plant just to share with neighbors, so that even if you don't buy in and have a bed and are one of the garden club members, you're still welcome here.
Lisa and Rick established this garden for a very tangible purpose: access to healthy food in a food desert. Over time, though, the garden has served additional intangible purposes, like connecting Santana and her family to their southern roots, and recently becoming a place where beauty is celebrated. At first, this meant flowers on the grounds. Natural for a garden, right?
Bloom MKE received a grant to get some public art in the garden. They went straight to gardeners for ideas, who came back to them with ideas on how to celebrate the community that was building there, as well as to serve a functional purpose, like benches that are easy for people with mobility issues to get into and out of, as well as a shade station held up by totems designed by local students, as well as murals to celebrate the gardeners there. Altogether, these pieces are helping the garden function as a gathering place, both for pollinators and for people.
I firmly believe that every neighborhood in this city deserves beauty. And so to me, as a total gardener geek, to me that was flowers. To me that was having the beauty of the natural surroundings. But then when we had this opportunity to get this community challenge grant from the Joy Engine Project, they gave us, you know, the money and the founding and honestly the inspiration to say, hey, what else could you do here? And it has been out of this world transformational to me. As beautiful as it is, it's just a whole nother level now that there's art in the space. So they gave us this grant in the summer of 2022. And in the fall, we started meeting with gardeners and doing listening sessions and saying, what would you want to see? And some themes came out really strongly. One was the gardeners felt that this is a space that's important for community building and community gathering. So they wanted to see more seating. They wanted to see some shade. I mean, you know, none of us love sitting on the hot sun, but especially if, you know, if you're elderly or if you're on some, you know, blood pressure medications, that hot sun can be dangerous. So we had the idea of part of the art could be this shade oasis that we're sitting in right now. And so, you know, we have the shade sail above us, but then instead of just having posts in the ground, we have these totems that were designed by Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design students and then carved by University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee architecture students. So we have these carved totem posts holding up the shade sail. And then we have these amazing benches that were designed by the architecture students and built by them. And they are creative and comfortable,
yeah,
I'm glad to say.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's been really amazing to have this little oasis right in the middle of the garden. So you can sit here and look out at your plants and enjoy the natural beauty and be very comfortable doing that. But then if you look around at the five different mural projects that are in here, it just blows my mind. Each one was done by a different Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design or a MIED student or a group of students. But what you see is that they really heard from the listening sessions that we shared with them how important it was to that the garden talk about family, that it talk about legacy and the legacy of agriculture for people moving up from the South, and as well as the sense of community they wanted to feel in this space. So when you look at these pieces, they're all unique and different. The artists have totally different styles, but you absolutely feel that sense of groundedness and community and family and how important the agricultural roots that this community has, even though they're now living in urban settings. And so to me, each piece really powerfully speaks for itself.
One of those MIAD design students that Lisa mentioned is Isaac Pulliam. He met Lisa and Rick through the school's service learning program, and he was immediately drawn to the project. He listened to stories about Santana and her grandmother and knew he wanted to feature them in a mural that he would create for the garden.
Well, when we heard about this opportunity, it was in the middle of winter, so there wasn't much action here in the garden. So
you don't really go outside in the winter.
Yeah. So basically, I just got a whole lot of photos from Lisa of Santana and her family, and I just created a Photoshop composition of the different photos that I had from them.
Now, Isaac is a humble guy, and he's not one to talk himself up, and believe me, I tried to get him to do so. Because this is a beautiful piece. Beautiful in just a matter-of-fact, everyday slice-of-life kind of sense. It captures Santana and her grandmother carrying their harvest home amidst a backdrop of cherry trees and fruiting tomatoes. When you look at the mural, it's as if Santana just noticed you standing there, while her grandmother just looks ready to get home and fry some fresh tomatoes after a long day harvesting. And Isaac is happy with how the piece turned out, but he's also happy with where it ended up. He sees gardens as a natural place for the visual arts to live, because he sees gardeners as artists who have a similar process to muralists like himself, but just happen to use soil as their medium instead of paint.
It's a good feeling to be part of this community, and especially being in a community of gardeners, there's a lot of connections that go hand in hand with gardening and art. especially like from beginning to end, deciding out, you got to planning out like the process, you got to plan out everything, like how you're going to apply everything, what materials you have to use that gets put into everything, and you don't really know how it's going to turn out until it's a finished product.
After spending about an hour in the garden with Santana, Lisa, and Isaac, it felt like an extended exhale. More than a breath of fresh air, Cherry Street is a reminder of how beautiful our city can be when we take the time to nurture and appreciate it. For Lake Effect, I'm Sam Woods.
The Cherry Street Community Garden is located near 23rd and Cherry Street and is managed by Bloom MKE, a nonprofit organization that uses gardening to foster community engagement. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Kothee Dance Company in Milwaukee preserves and teaches dance and music rooted in the cultures of the African diaspora. But after 56 years, the company has lost thousands in funding from the federal government. We'll learn about their efforts to stay in business tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.